Had he believed she would do it, he would have physically prevented her. It would not have been difficult. Instead, the young man sat slumped at the table, a wine bottle in one hand, a cigarette burning between the fingers of the other, watching her as she plunged about, gathering belongings, preparing for her journey. She wasn't looking at him now. The hours of accusation, anger, panic were over. Her eyes were dry, although she breathed unevenly, throat and chest tight as she moved fast between the two rooms, bare feet slapping on the floorboards. Drawing the nicotine into him, narrowing his eyes against the smoke, the young man watched her. The sound, as he exhaled, was a sigh of exasperation. From time to time, he refilled his glass and drank. He thought she wouldn't go. He thought she hadn't the courage. The journey out would be daunting, not merely a short drive across town to some sympathetic woman friend or to her mother's welcoming house. There was no woman friend. No mother. No town, even. Very soon it would be dark. The highway was 4 hours away, along a track that was rough and hard to follow. The old van was unreliable. In the morning, when the sun rose, early and blinding, the heat would become so extreme that if stranded, she and the kids would not make it through the day. His eyes watching her were hard, like a lizard's eyes, or a snake's. She wondered how it was that she hadn't seen the hardness. She had thought him brilliant, excusing his behavior as the eccentricity of an artist, the unrecognized genius whom she would nurture. He had seemed vulnerable, focused. But slowly he had revealed himself. Blow by blow, she'd felt the shock of him, the willful irresponsibility, the brutality of his selfishness, the callousness. It was 4 years since they'd left the city to live in Opal Country near Yawa. While he had painted the strange terrain and its bizarre inhabitants, pouring wine down his throat and kippering his damaged lungs, his stark, wild canvases accumulating, she had given birth to twin boys, conceived, carried, and delivered them in the tiny, sweltering hut with its creaking iron roof, its veranda throwing a dense shadow on the surrounding sun-bleached grit. While she suckled her babies and weaned them, her only friend had been an old man. An old, lunatic man. An old, mad, fussocking man. Charlie, with his crazy stories of his cache of opals. They had sat together, Charlie and she, countless hours in the thick shade of the veranda, dazed by the heat, taking it in turns to play solitaire. Charlie would arrive, with the Hessian bag swinging on its drawstring, the marbles rattling against the worn wooden board, his threadbare pocket bulging round a whiskey bottle. Reaching into the bag, the woman would withdraw the marbles, a handful at a time, and as Charlie watched, placing the bottle carefully against his chair leg, would set one into each shallow indentation of the board, her foot rocking the cradle in which her boys lay, fretful and clammy in the heat. Finishing her game, she would shrug and smile, pushing the board towards him. "Your go, Charlie." He told her, as he moved the marbles on the board, of his years of fossicking, of his finds and his disappointments, of the folk he'd seen come and go, good men and bad, kind and cruel, the idle and the obsessed. A few had made it back into the world, rich beyond their dreams. Most broken, their strength and resolution sweated out of them, dragged themselves away. Some into their graves amongst the diggings. But Charlie had stayed on, longer than any, his cache of stones slowly accumulating. He taught her how to distinguish valuable gems from worthless opaline. In the shadow of the veranda, he described the deep flowing colors, caught and held by the fires that had created them. When she asked him why he'd never left, never gone to the city to sell his stones and spend the money they would fetch, he'd shake his head and smile, squinting out into the glare. "Reckon this'll do me," he would say. And she wondered, watching as his calloused fingers moved the marbles on the solitaire board, whether it was true what people said, that he had few gems of any worth, that his fabulous collection existed only in a mind addled by the hot sun, clouded by the whiskey with which he deadened the aches in his old, bruised bones. "You shouldn't be here," he'd say to her, and his eyes would slide past her to rest accusingly on the young man. She dumped the duffel bags into the truck, loaded spare cans of petrol and of water, spread sleeping bags in the back, and still the man sat motionless at the table. One by one, she lifted the drowsing children from their beds and settled them in the truck. Finally, she returned to the kitchen and met the man's eyes. He was rolling his next cigarette, his unwatched fingers performing the familiar sequence of movements, heavy-lidded eyes fixed on the woman's face. "I'm going now," was all she said. A battered tin of cannabis clattered to the floor as his chair scraped back, but the woman turned abruptly and went out into the darkness. The keys were already in the ignition switch, and the engine fired at once, noisily, in the silence. Dust flew as the tires spun and then gripped. By the time the man stumbled out onto the veranda, the truck's taillights were already blurred, smudged by raised dust. As the reality of her departure reached him, and he hurled her name uselessly after her, a sensation which neither wine nor cannabis would deaden began to hollow out his chest. In the driving mirror, the darkness closed behind her. He might try to follow. The single beam from the headlight of his old trial bike was what she feared to see, closing the distance between them. But nothing was visible beyond the eerie red glow of her own taillights, while her headlights dazzled on the pale sand of the track, accentuating the movement of the vehicle as it plunged violently over the potholed surface. She eased her back against the seat and flexed her fingers, changing her grip on the wheel, bracing herself for the long hours of driving which lay ahead. Then, caught weirdly by her lights, a vague blur solidified directly in her path. She braked hard, and the wheels locked into a dusty slither. The children, thrown forward, protested, struggled with their sleeping bags, and peered, as the woman was peering, through the windscreen. It was the old man. He shuffled towards them, head down, smiling, and came round to the side window. "I could have killed you, Charlie!" He leaned in, the hooded eyes scanning her face. He was inches from her, and she could smell the sweat, tobacco, stale booze. She could see the leathery pores of his grimed skin. His eyes narrowed as he read her face. "You going, ain't you?" he said, resigned to her departure. "And not before time. I shall miss you. Here." He was holding something out to her, pushing it in through the truck window. "Take it, girlie." The marbles rattled. The Hessian bag was rough against her resisting hand.
"No, Charlie, I couldn't."
"Go on," he insisted. "Have it as a keepsake." He stepped back, turned, and was instantly absorbed by the indigo darkness. It was after midnight when she drove through the town and out onto the highway. 2 hours later, she pulled into a wayside motel. The dreary room was dank. Its overworked air conditioner rattled and dripped. She laid the sleeping babies in one of the two beds and stood a long time, letting the lukewarm water of the shower flow over her. Past sleep, she lay exhausted in the darkness, shaken by the heavy thump of her heartbeat. A conversation was taking place in her head, the thoughts colliding. "How has this happened? Why have I done this? Why now?" "Because he doesn't care for us, provide for us, or protect us. Because we would have died of him if we'd stayed in that place. the boys sickening, while he drank the money. She reached across the empty space beside her in the bed, moving her hand over the tightly stretched, chill sheet, the hard, smooth pillow. It was over. She was out, away, alone. The regular breathing of her children seemed to isolate her further. She withdrew her hand, and finally, exhausted, slipped into a shallow sleep, from which, subconsciously overtaken by panic, she woke abruptly, overwhelmed by the realization that she had planned nothing beyond her departure. She switched on the light. 2 hours yet, of darkness. She must be calm. She must rest. Sleep was clearly impossible. But she must not think, because in these small, unnerving hours of darkness, thought might drive her back to the man and to the life from which she and her children must escape. There were no books in the room, not even a Gideon Bible in the bedside drawer. But the solitaire board lay in its Hessian bag on the dressing table. She loosened the drawstring and shook out the contents onto the bed cover. There was more than the board and the marbles in the bag. At first, she thought the gleaming chunks were simply opaline. But as she examined them, turning them slowly in the light, and saw the veins glinting with rich, outrageous color, she perceived their value. These were not the cheap trophies of an amateur fossicker. This was the pick of Charlie's finds, the result of all his years of labor in the opal diggings. Of course, she could not accept them. She cursed him, knowing she must return the opals to him, knowing that to leave Yawa a second time might prove impossible for her. Damn you, Charlie. She unfolded a twist of paper, which lay among the stones. Words had been laboriously printed with a blunt pencil. She tilted them towards the light. "I don't want no nonsense, girlie," she read. "Take them to the address on the card. Good luck, from your friend, Charlie." A dog-eared business card bore the name and address of a gemstone dealer in the city. In the black night at Yawa, a sudden silence woke the young man. The tilly lamp, having sucked the last of its supply of kerosene, had abruptly ceased its hissing. He stumbled out onto the veranda and dropped into a creaking wicker chair whose cushions smelled faintly of the children who had played in it that day. He fixed his eyes on an almost indistinguishable point where the dense land met the paler sky. The point where, should the woman return, he would first see her headlights probing the darkness. But he knew now that she would not return. Had she lost her resolve, it would have been sooner than this. "Dull?" The silence snuffed the word. Now he was alone, cowering beneath the moonless arc of the sky and the senselessly spinning stars. The woman reread Charlie's note several times and stared for a while at the objects scattered on the bed cover. Carefully, she gathered them up and replaced them in the Hessian bag, tightened the drawstring, laid the bag under her pillow, and slept until the sun rose.